set out to save man from this. I was very angry. I'd left my chair and walked out into the courtyard. She came right behind me. "You have just given the oldest argument in Christendom for the existence of evil," she said. "It exists so that we may fight it and do good."
"How dreary and stupid," I said.
"What I don't understand about you is this," she said. "You hold to your old belief in goodness with a tenacity that is virtually unshakable. Yet you are so good at being what you are. You hunt your victims like a dark angel. You kill ruthlessly. You feast all the night long on victims when you choose."
"So?"
I looked at her coldly.
"I don't know how to be bad at being bad."
She laughed.
"I was a good marksman when I was a young man," I said. "A good actor on the stage. And now I am a good vampire."
So much for our understanding of the word good. After she had gone, I lay on my back on the flagstones in the courtyard and looked up at the stars, thinking of all the paintings and the sculptures that I had seen merely in the single city of Florence. I knew that I hated places where there are only towering trees, and the softest and sweetest music to me was the sound of human voices. But what did it matter really what I thought or felt? But she didn't always bludgeon me with strange philosophy. Now and then, when she appeared, she spoke of the practical things she'd learned. She was actually braver and more adventurous than I was. She taught me things. We could sleep in the earth, she had ascertained that before we ever left France. Coffins and graves did not matter. And she would find herself rising naturally out of the earth at sunset even before she was awake. And those mortals who did find us during the daylight hours, unless they exposed us to the sun at once, were doomed. For example, outside Palermo, she had slept in a cellar far below an abandoned house, and when she had awakened, her eyes and face were burning as if they had been scalded, and she had in her right hand a mortal, quite dead, who had apparently attempted to disturb her rest. "He was strangled," she said, "and my hand was still locked on his throat. And my face had been burned by the little light that leaked down from the open door."
"What if there had been several mortals?" I asked, vaguely enchanted with her.
She shook her head and shrugged. She always slept in the earth now, not in cellars or coffins. No one would ever disturb her rest again. It did not matter to her. I did not say so, but I believed there was a grace in sleeping in the crypt. There was a romance to rising from the grave. I was in fact going to the very opposite extreme, in that I had coffins made for myself in places where we lingered, and I slept not in the graveyard or the church, as was our most common custom, but in hiding places within the house. I can't say that she didn't sometimes patiently listen to me when I told her these things. She listened when I described to her the great works of art I had seen in the Vatican Museum, or the chorus I had heard in the cathedral, or the dreams I had in the last hour before rising, dreams that seemed to be sparked by the thoughts of mortals passing my lair. But maybe she was watching my lips move. Who could possibly tell? And then she was gone again, without explanation, and I walked the streets alone, whispering aloud to Marius and writing to him the long, long messages that took the whole night sometimes to complete. What did I want of her? That she be more human? That she be like me? Armand's predictions obsessed me. And how could she not think of them? She must have known what was happening, that we were growing ever farther apart, that my heart was breaking, and I had too much pride to say it to her. "Please, Gabriel, I cannot endure the loneliness. Stay with me." By the time we left Italy, I was playing dangerous little games with mortals. I'd see a man, or a woman, a human being who looked perfect to me spiritually, and I would follow the human about. Maybe for a week I'd do this, then a month, sometimes even longer than that. I'd fall in love with the being. I'd imagine friendship, conversation, intimacy that we could never have. In some magical and imaginary moment I would say, "But you see what I am?"
And this human being in supreme spiritual understanding would say, "Yes, I see. I understand." Nonsense. Really? Very like the fairy tale where the princess gives her selfless love to the prince, who is enchanted, and he is himself again, and the monster no more. Only in this dark fairy tale I would pass right into my mortal lover. We would become one being, and I would be flesh and blood again. Lovely idea, that. Only I began to think more and more of Armand's warnings, that I'd work the dark trick again for the same reasons I'd done it before. And I stopped playing the game altogether. I merely went hunting with all the old vengeance and cruelty, and it wasn't merely the evildoer I brought down. In the city of Athens, I wrote the following message to Marius. "I do not know why I go on. I do not search for truth. I do not believe in it. I hope for no ancient secrets from you, whatever they may be. But I believe in something. Maybe simply in the beauty of the world through which I wander, or in the will to live itself. This gift was given to me too early. It was given for no good reason. And already, at the age of 30 mortal years, I have some understanding as to why so many of our kind have wasted it, given it up. Yet I continue, and I search for you." How long I could have wandered through Europe and Asia in this fashion, I do not know. For all my complaints about loneliness, I was used to it all. And there were new cities as there were new victims, new languages and new music to hear. No matter what my pain, I fixed my mind on a new destination. I wanted to know all the cities of the earth, finally, even the far-off capitals of India and China, where the simplest objects would seem alien, and the minds I pierced as strange as those of creatures from another world. But as we went south from Istanbul into Asia Minor, Gabrielle felt the allure of the new and strange land even more strongly, so that she was scarcely ever at my side. And things were reaching a horrid climax in France. Not merely with the mortal world I still grieved for, but with the vampires of the theatre as well. 3. Before I ever left Greece, I'd been hearing disturbing news from English and French travellers of the troubles at home, and when I reached the European hostelry in Ankara, there was a large packet of letters waiting for me. Roger had moved all of my money out of France and into foreign banks. "You must not consider returning to Paris," he wrote. "I have advised your father and your brothers to keep out of all controversy. It is not the climate for monarchists here." Eleni's letters spoke in their own way of the same things. "Audiences want to see the aristocracy made fools of. Our little play featuring a clumsy queen puppet who is trampled mercilessly by the mindless troop of puppet soldiers whom she seeks to command draws loud laughter and screams. The clergy is also ripe for derision. In another little drama, we have a bumptious priest come to chastise a group of dancing girl marionettes for their indecent conduct. But alas, their dancing master, who is in fact a red-horned devil, turns the unfortunate cleric into a werewolf who ends his days kept by the laughing girls in a golden cage. All this is the genius of our divine violinist. But we must now be with him every waking moment. To force him to write, we tie him to the chair. We put ink and paper in front of him, and if this fails, we make him dictate as we write down the plays. In the streets, he would accost the passers-by, and tell them passionately there are horrors in this world of which they do not dream. And I assure you, if Paris were not so busy reading pamphlets that denounce Queen Marie Antoinette, he might have undone us all by now. Our oldest friend becomes more angry with every passing night." Of course I wrote to her at once, begging her to be patient with Nicky, to try to help him through these first years. "Surely he can be influenced," I said, and for the first time I asked, "Would I have the power to alter things if I were to return?" I stared at the words for a long time before signing my name. My hands were trembling. Then I sealed the letter and posted it at once. How could I go back? Lonely as I was, I couldn't bear the thought of returning to Paris, of seeing that little theatre again. And what would I do for Nicholas when I got there? Armand's long-ago admonition was a din in my ears. In fact, it seemed, no matter where I was, that Armand and Nicky were both with me, Armand full of grim warnings and predictions, and Nicholas taunting me with a little miracle of love turned into hate. I had never needed Gabrielle as I did now. But she had gone ahead on our journey long ago. Now and then I remembered the way it had been before we ever left Paris. But I didn't expect anything from her any more. At Damascus, Eleni's answer was waiting for me. "He despises you as much as ever. When we suggest that perhaps he should go to you, he laughs and laughs. I tell you these things not to haunt you, but to let you know that we do our utmost to protect this child who should never have been born to darkness. He is overwhelmed by his powers, dazzled and maddened by his vision. We have seen it all and its sorry finish before. Yet he has written his greatest play this last month. The marionette dancers, sans strings for this one, are in the flower of their youth, struck down by a pestilence and laid beneath tombstones and flower wreaths to rest. The priest weeps over them before he goes away. But a young violinist magician comes to the cemetery, and by means of his music makes them rise. As vampires dressed all in black silk ruffles and black satin ribbons, they come out of the graves, dancing merrily as they follow the violinist towards Paris, a beautifully rendered painting on the scrim. The crowd positively roars. I tell you, we could feast on mortal victims on the stage, and the Parisians, thinking it all the most novel illusion, would only cheer. There was also a frightening letter from Roger. Paris was in the grip of revolutionary madness. King Louis had been forced to recognize the National Assembly. The people of all classes were uniting against him as never before. Roger had sent a messenger south to see my family and try to determine the revolutionary mood in the countryside for himself. I answered both letters with all the predictable concern and all the predictable feeling of helplessness. But as I sent my belongings on to Cairo, I had the dread that all those things upon which I depended were in danger. Outwardly, I was unchanged as I continued my masquerade as the travelling gentleman. Inwardly, the demon hunter of the crooked back streets was silently and secretly lost. Of course, I told myself that it was important to go south to Egypt, that Egypt was a land of ancient grandeur and timeless marvels, that Egypt would enchant me and make me forget the things happening in Paris which I was powerless to change. But there was a connection in my mind. Egypt, more than any other land the world over, was a place in love with death. Finally, Gabrielle came like a spirit out of the Arabian desert, and together we set sail. It was almost a month before we reached Cairo, and when I found my belongings waiting for me in the European hostelry, there was a strange package there. I recognized Eleni's writing immediately, but I could not think why she would send me a package, and I stared at the thing for a full quarter of an hour, my mind as blank as it had ever been. There was not a word from Roger. Why hasn't Roger written to me, I thought. What is this package? Why is it here? At last I realized that for an hour I had been sitting in a room with a lot of trunks and packing cases, and staring at a package, and that Gabrielle, who had not seen fit to vanish yet, was merely watching me. "Would you go out?" I whispered. "If you wish," she said. It was important to open this. Yes, to open it and find out what it was. Yet it seemed just as important for me to look around the barren little room and imagine that it was a room in a village inn in the Auvergne. "I had a dream about you," I said aloud, glancing at the package. "I dreamed that we were moving through the world together, you and I, and we were both serene and strong. I dreamed we fed on the evildoer, as Marius had done. And as we looked about ourselves, we felt awe and sorrow at the mysteries we beheld. That we were strong, we would go on forever. And we talked. Our conversation went on and on." I tore back the wrapping and saw the case of the Stradivarius violin. I went to say something again, just to myself, but my throat closed, and my mind couldn't carry out the words on its own. I reached for the letter, which had slipped to one side over the polished wood.
"It has come to the worst, as I feared. Our oldest friend, maddened by the excesses of our violinist, finally imprisoned him in your old residence. And though his violin was given him in his cell, his hands were taken away. But understand that, with us, such appendages can always be restored. And the appendages in question were kept safe by our oldest friend, who allowed our wounded one no sustenance for 5 nights. Finally, after the entire troop had prevailed upon our oldest friend to release N and give back to him all that was his, it was done. But N, maddened by the pain and the starvation, for this can alter the temperament completely, slipped into unbreakable silence and remained so for a considerable length of time. At last he came to us, and spoke only to tell us that in the manner of a mortal he had put in order his business affairs. A stack of freshly written plays was ours to have, and we must call together for him somewhere in the countryside, the ancient Sabbat with its customary blaze. If we did not, then he would make the theatre his funeral pyre. Our oldest friend solemnly granted his wish, and you have never seen such a Sabbat as this, for I think we looked all the more hellish in our wigs and fine clothes, our black ruffled vampire dancing costumes, forming the old circle, singing with an actor's bravado the old chants. "We should have done it on the boulevard," he said. "But here, send this on to my maker," and he put the violin in my hands. We began to dance, all of us, to induce the customary frenzy, and I think we were never more moved, never more in terror, never more sad. He went into the flames. I know how this news will affect you, but understand, we did all that we could to prevent what occurred. Our oldest friend was bitter and grieved, and I think you should know that when we returned to Paris, we discovered that N had ordered the theatre to be named officially the Theatre of the Vampires, and these words had already been painted on the front. As his best plays have always included vampires and werewolves and other such supernatural creatures, the public thinks the new title very amusing, and no one has moved to change it. It is merely clever in the Paris of these times.
Hours later, when I finally went down the stairs into the street, I saw a pale and lovely ghost in the shadows. Image of the young French explorer, in soiled white linen and brown leather boots, straw hat down over the eyes. I knew who she was, of course, and that we had once loved each other, she and I. But it seemed for the moment to be something I could scarce remember or truly believe. I think I wanted to say something mean to her, to wound her and drive her away. But when she came up beside me and walked with me, I didn't say anything. I merely gave the letter to her so that we didn't have to talk. And she read it and put it away. And then she had her arm around me again the way she used to long ago, and we were walking together through the black streets. Smell of death and cooking fires, of sand and camel dung, Egypt smell, smell of a place that has been the same for 6,000 years.
"What can I do for you, my darling?" she whispered.
"Nothing," I said. It was I who did it. I who seduced him, made him what he was, and left him there. It was I who subverted the path his life might have taken. And so, in dark obscurity, removed from its human course, it comes to this. Later she stood silent as I wrote my message to Marius on an ancient temple wall. I told about the end of Nicholas, the violinist of the Theatre of the Vampires, and I carved my words deep as any ancient Egyptian craftsman might have done. Epitaph for Nicky, a milestone in oblivion which none might ever read or understand. It was strange to have her there. Strange to have her staying with me hour by hour.
"You won't go back to France, will you?" she asked me finally.
"You won't go back on account of what he's done?"
"The hands?" I asked. "The cutting off of the hands?"
She looked at me, and her face smoothed out as if some shock had robbed it of expression. But she knew. She had read the letter. What shocked her? The way I said it, perhaps.
You thought I would go back to get revenge?
She nodded uncertainly. She didn't want to put the idea in my head.
How could I do that?
I said. It would be hypocrisy, wouldn't it? When I left Nicholas there counting on them all to do whatever had to be done. The changes in her face were too subtle to describe. I didn't like to see her feel so much. It wasn't like her.
The fact is, the little monster was trying to help when he did it, don't you think, when he cut off the hands? It must have been a lot of trouble to him, really, when he could have burnt up Nicky so easily without a backward glance.
She nodded, but she looked miserable. And as luck would have it, beautiful, too.
I rather thought so, she said. But I didn't think he would agree.
Oh, I'm monster enough to understand it, I said. Do you remember what you told me years ago, before we ever left home? You said it the very day that he came up the mountain with the merchants to give me the red cloak. You said that his father was so angry with him for his violin playing that he was threatening to break his hands. Do you think we find our destiny somehow, no matter what happens? I mean, do you think that even as immortals we follow some path that was already marked for us when we were alive? Imagine it. The Coven Master cut off his hands. It was clear in the nights that followed that she didn't want to leave me alone, and I sensed that she would have stayed on account of Nicky's death no matter where we were. But it made a difference that we were in Egypt. It helped that she loved these ruins and these monuments as she had loved none before. Maybe people had to be dead 6,000 years for her to love them. I thought of saying that to her, teasing her with it a little, but the thought merely came and went. These monuments were as old as the mountains she loved. The Nile had coursed through the imagination of man since the dawn of recorded time. We scaled the pyramids together. We climbed into the arms of the giant Sphinx. We pored over inscriptions of ancient stone fragments. We studied the mummies one could buy from thieves for a pittance, bits of old jewelry, pottery, glass. We let the water of the river move through our fingers, and we hunted the tiny streets of Cairo together, and we went into the brothels to sit back on the pillows and watch the boys dance and hear the musicians play a heated, erotic music that drowned out for a little while the sound of a violin that was always in my head. I found myself rising and dancing wildly to these exotic sounds, imitating the undulations of those who urged me on, as I lost all sense of time or reason in the wail of the horns, the strumming of the lutes. Gabrielle sat still, smiling, with the brim of her soiled white straw hat over her eyes. We did not talk to each other any more. She was just some pale and feline beauty, cheek smudged with dirt, who drifted through the endless night at my side. Her coat cinched by a thick leather belt, her hair in a braid down her back, she walked with a queen's posture and a vampire's languor. The curve of her cheek, luminous in the darkness, her small mouth a blur of rose red. Lovely, and soon to be gone again, no doubt. Yet she remained with me, even when I leased a lavish little dwelling, once the house of a Mameluk lord, with gorgeously tiled floors and elaborate tent work hanging from its ceilings. She even helped me fill the courtyard with bougainvillea and palms and every kind of tropical plant until it was a verdant little jungle. She brought in the caged parrots and finches and brilliant canaries herself. She even nodded now and then sympathetically when I murmured there were no letters from Paris, and I was frantic for news. Why hadn't Roger written to me? Had Paris erupted into riots and mayhem? Well, it would never touch my distant provincial family, would it? But had something happened to Roger? Why didn't he write? She asked me to go upriver with her. I wanted to wait for letters to question the English travellers, but I agreed. After all, it was rather remarkable, really, that she wanted me to come with her. She was caring for me in her own way. I knew she'd taken to dressing in fresh white linen frock coats and breeches only to please me,
For me she brushed out her long hair. But it did not matter at all. I was sinking. I could feel it. I was drifting through the world as if it were a dream. It seemed very natural and reasonable that around me I should see a landscape that looked exactly as it had thousands of years ago, when artists painted it on the walls of royal tombs. Natural that the palm trees in the moonlight should look exactly as they looked then. Natural that the peasant should draw his water from the river in the same manner as he had done then, and the cows he watered were the same too. Visions of the world when the world had been new. Had Marius ever stood in these sands? We wandered through the giant temple of Ramses, enchanted by the millions upon millions of tiny pictures cut into the walls. I kept thinking of Osiris, but the little figures were strangers. We prowled at the ruins of Luxor. We lay in the riverboat together under the stars. On our way back to Cairo, when we came to the great colossi of Memnon, she told me in a passionate whisper how Roman emperors had journeyed to marvel at these statues just as we did now. "They were ancient in the times of the Caesars," she said, as we rode our camels through the cool sands. The wind was not so bad as it could have been on this night. We could see the immense stone figures clearly against the deep blue sky. Faces blasted away, they seemed nevertheless to stare forward, mute witnesses to the passage of time, whose stillness made me sad and afraid. I felt the same wonder I had known before the pyramids. Ancient gods, ancient mysteries. It made the chills rise. And yet what were these figures now but faceless sentinels, rulers of an endless waste? "Marius," I whispered to myself, "have you seen these? Will any one of us endure so long?" But my reverie was broken by Gabrielle. She wanted to dismount and walk the rest of the way to the statues. I was game for it, though I didn't really know what to do with the big, smelly, stubborn camels, how to make them kneel down and all that. She did it, and she left them waiting for us, and we walked through the sand. "Come with me into Africa. Into the jungles," she said. Her face was grave, her voice unusually soft. I didn't answer for a moment. Something in her manner alarmed me, or at least it seemed I should have been alarmed. I should have heard a sound as sharp as the morning chime of hell's bells. I didn't want to go into the jungles of Africa, and she knew I didn't. I was anxiously awaiting news of my family from Roger, and I had it in my mind to seek the cities of the Orient, to wander through India, into China, and on to Japan. "I understand the existence you've chosen," she said, "and I've come to admire the perseverance with which you pursue it. You must know that." "I might say the same of you," I said a little bitterly. She stopped. We were as near to the colossal statues as one should get, I suppose. And the only thing that saved them from overwhelming me was that there was nothing near at hand to put them in scale. The sky overhead was as immense as they were, and the sands endless, and the stars countless and brilliant and rising forever overhead. "Lestat," she said slowly, measuring her words, "I am asking you to try, only once, to move through the world as I do." The moon shone full on her, but the hat shadowed her small, angular white face. "Forget the house in Cairo," she said suddenly, dropping her voice as if in respect for the importance of what she said. "Abandon all your valuables, your clothes, the things that link you with civilization. Come south with me, up the river into Africa. Travel with me as I travel." Still I didn't answer. My heart was pounding. She murmured softly under her breath that we should see the secret tribes of Africa unknown to the world. We would fight the crocodile and the lion with our bare hands. We might find the source of the Nile itself. I began to tremble all over. It was as if the night were full of howling winds, and there was no place to go. "You are saying you will leave me forever if I don't come. Isn't that it?" I looked up at these horrific statues. I think I said, "So it comes to this."
And this was why she had stayed close to me. This was why she had done so many little things to please. This was why we were together now. It had nothing to do with Nicky gone into eternity. It was another parting that concerned her now. She shook her head as if communing with herself, debating on how to go on. In a hushed voice she described to me the heat of tropical nights, wetter, sweeter than this heat. "Come with me, Lestat," she said. "By day I sleep in the sand. By night I am on the wing as if I could truly fly. I need no name. I leave no footprints. I want to go down to the very tip of Africa. I will be a goddess to those I slay."
She approached and slipped her arm about my shoulder and pressed her lips to my cheek, and I saw the deep glitter of her eyes beneath the brim of her hat, and the moonlight icing her mouth. I heard myself sigh. I shook my head. "I can't, and you know it," I said. "I can't do it any more than you can stay with me."
All the way back to Cairo, I thought on it. What had come to me in those painful moments. What I had known but not said as we stood before the colossi of Memnon in the sand. She was already lost to me. She had been for years. I had known it when I came down the stairs from the room in which I grieved for Nicky, and I had seen her waiting for me. It had all been said in one form or another in the crypt beneath the tower years ago. She could not give me what I wanted of her. There was nothing I could do to make her what she would not be. And the truly terrible part was this. She really didn't want anything of me. She was asking me to come because she felt the obligation to do so. Pity, sadness, maybe those were also reasons, but what she really wanted was to be free. She stayed with me as we returned to the city. She did and said nothing. And I was sinking even lower, silent, stunned, knowing that another dreadful blow would soon fall. There was the clarity and the horror. She will say her farewell, and I can't prevent it. When do I start to lose my senses? When do I begin to cry uncontrollably? Not now. As we lighted the lamps of the little house, the colors assaulted me. Persian carpets covered with delicate flowers. The tent work woven with a million tiny mirrors. The brilliant plumage of the fluttering birds. I looked for a packet from Roger, but there was none, and I became angry suddenly. Surely he would have written by now. I had to know what was going on in Paris. Then I became afraid. "What the hell is happening in France?" I murmured. "I have to go and find other Europeans. The British, they always have information. They drag their damned Indian tea and their London Times with them wherever they go." I was infuriated to see her standing there so still. It was as if something were happening in the room, that awful sense of tension and anticipation that I'd known in the crypt before Armand told us his long tale. But nothing was happening, only that she was about to leave me forever. She was about to slip into time forever. And how would we ever find each other again? "Damn it," I said. "I expected a letter." No servants. They hadn't known when we would be back. I wanted to send someone to hire musicians. I had just fed and I was warm, and I told myself that I wanted to dance. She broke her stillness suddenly. She started to move in a rather deliberate way. With uncommon directness, she went into the courtyard. I watched her kneel down by the pond. There she lifted two blocks of paving, and she took out a packet and brushed the sandy earth off it, and she brought it to me. Even before she brought it into the light, I saw it was from Roger. This had come before we had ever gone up the Nile, and she had hidden it. "But why did you do this?" I said. I was in a fury. I snatched the package from her and put it down on the desk. I was staring at her and hating her as never before. Not even in the egotism of childhood had I hated her as I did now. "Why did you hide this from me?" I said.
"Because I wanted one chance," she whispered.
Her chin was trembling, her lower lip quivered, and I saw the blood tears.
"But without this, even," she said, "you have made your choice."
I reached down and tore the packet apart. A letter slipped out of it,
along with folded clippings from an English paper. I unraveled the letter, my hands shaking, and I started to read.
"Monsieur, as you must know by now, on July 14th, the mobs of Paris attacked the Bastille. The city is in chaos. There have been riots all over France. For months I have sought in vain to reach your people, to get them out of the country safely if I could. But on Monday last, I received the word that your peasants and tenant farmers had risen against your father's house. Your brothers, their wives and children, and all who tried to defend the castle were slain before it was looted. Only your father escaped. Loyal servants managed to conceal him during the siege and later to get him to the coast. He is on this very day in the city of New Orleans, in the former French colony of Louisiana, and he begs you to come to his aid. He is grief-stricken and among strangers. He begs for you to come."
There was more. Apologies, assurances, particulars. It ceased to make sense. I put the letter down on the desk. I stared at the wood and the pool of light made by the lamp.
"Don't go to him," she said.
Her voice was small and insignificant in the silence, but the silence was like an immense scream.
"Don't go to him," she said again.
The tears streaked her face like clown paint, two long streams of red coming from her eyes.
"Get out," I whispered.
The word trailed off, and suddenly my voice swelled again. "Get out," I said, and again my voice didn't stop. It merely went on until I said the words again with shattering violence. "Get out!"
4. I dreamed a dream of family. We were all embracing one another. Even Gabrielle in a velvet gown was there. The castle was blackened, all burnt up. The treasures I had deposited were melted or turned into ashes. It always comes back to ashes. But is the old quote actually ashes to ashes or dust to dust? It didn't matter. I had gone back and made them all into vampires, and there we were, the house de Liancourt, white-faced beauties even to the blood-sucking baby that lay in the cradle and the mother who bent to give it the wriggling, long-tailed grey rat upon which it was to feed. We laughed, and we kissed one another as we walked through the ashes, my white brothers, their white wives, the ghostly children chattering together about victims, my blind father who, like a biblical figure, had risen crying, "I can see!" My oldest brother put his arm around me. He looked marvelous in decent clothes. I'd never seen him look so good, and the vampiric blood had made him so spare and so spiritual in expression. "You know, it's a damn good thing you came when you did with all the dark gifts," he laughed cheerily. "The dark tricks, dear, the dark tricks," said his wife. "Because if you hadn't," he continued, "why, we'd all be dead."
5. The house was empty. The trunks had been sent on. The ship would leave Alexandria in 2 nights. Only a small valise remained with me. On shipboard, the son of the Marquis must now and then change his clothes. And, of course, the violin. Gabrielle stood by the archway to the garden, slender, long-legged, beautifully angular in her white cotton garments, the hat on as always, her hair loose. Was that for me, the long, loose hair? My grief was rising, a tide that included all the losses, the dead and the undead. But it went away, and the sense of sinking returned, the sense of the dream in which we navigate with or without will. It struck me that her hair might have been described as a shower of gold, that all the old poetry makes sense when you look at one whom you have loved. Lovely the angles of her face, her implacable little mouth. "Tell me what you need of me, mother," I said quietly. "Civilized, this room. Desk. Lamp. Chair. All my brilliantly colored birds given away, probably for sale in the bazaar. Grey African parrots that live to be as old as men." Nicky had lived to be 30. "Do you require money from me?" Great, beautiful flush to her face, eyes a flash of moving light, blue and violet. For a moment she looked human. We might as well have been standing in her room at home. Books, the damp walls, the fire. Was she human, then? The brim of the hat covered her face completely for an instant as she bowed her head. Inexplicably, she asked, "But where will you go?" "To a little house in the Rue du Maine, in the old French city of New Orleans," I answered coldly, precisely. "And after he has died and is at rest, I haven't the slightest idea."
"You can't mean this," she said.
"I am booked on the next ship out of Alexandria," I said. "I will go to Naples, then on to Barcelona. I will leave from Lisbon for the New World." Her face seemed to narrow, her features to sharpen. Her lips moved just a little, but she didn't say anything. And then I saw the tears rising in her eyes, and I felt her emotion as if it were reaching out to touch me. I looked away, busied myself with something on the desk, then simply held my hands very still so they wouldn't tremble. I thought, I am glad Nicky took his hands with him into the fire, because if he had not, I would have to go back to Paris and get them before I could go on.
"But you can't be going to him," she whispered.
"Him? Oh, my father. What does it matter? I am going," I said. She moved her head just a little in a negative gesture. She came near to the desk. Her step was lighter than Armand's.
"Has any of our kind ever made such a crossing?" she asked under her breath.
"Not that I know of. In Rome they said no.
Perhaps it can't be done, this crossing."
"It can be done. You know it can. We had sailed the seas before in our cork-lined coffins. Pity the Leviathan who troubles me." She came even nearer and looked down at me, and the pain in her face couldn't be concealed any more. Ravishing she was. Why had I ever dressed her in ball gowns or plumed hats or pearls? "You know where to reach me," I said, but the bitterness of my tone had no conviction to it. "The addresses of my banks, in London and Rome. Those banks have lived as long as vampires already. They will always be there. You know all this. You've always known."
"Stop," she said under her breath. "Don't say these things to me."
What a lie all this was. What a travesty. It was just the kind of exchange she had always detested, the kind of talk she could never make herself. In my wildest imaginings, I had never expected it to be like this, that I should say cold things, that she should cry. I thought I would bawl when she said she was going. I thought I would throw myself at her very feet. We looked at each other for a long moment, her eyes tinged with red, her mouth almost quivering. And then I lost my control. I rose and I went to her, and I gathered her small, delicate limbs in my arms. I determined not to let her go, no matter how she struggled, but she didn't struggle. And we both cried, almost silently, as if we couldn't make ourselves stop. But she didn't yield to me. She didn't melt in my embrace. And then she drew back. She stroked my hair with both her hands, and leant forward, and kissed me on the lips, and then moved away lightly and soundlessly.
"All right, then, my darling," she said.
I shook my head. Words and words and words unspoken. She had no use for them, and never had. In her slow, languid way, hips moving gracefully, she went to the door to the garden and looked up at the night sky before she looked back at me.
"You must promise me something," she said finally.
Bold young Frenchman who moved with the grace of an Arab, through places in 100 cities where only an alley cat could safely pass. "Of course," I answered. But I was so broken in spirit now I didn't want to talk any more. The colors dimmed. The night was neither hot nor cold. I wished she would just go, yet I was terrified of the moment when that would happen, when I couldn't get her back.
"Promise me you will never seek to end it," she said, "without first being with me, without our coming together again."
For a moment I was too surprised to answer. Then I said, "I will never seek to end it." I was almost scornful. "So you have my promise. It's simple enough to give. But what about you giving a promise to me? That you'll let me know where you go from here, where I can reach you, that you won't vanish as if you were something I imagined?" I stopped. There had been a note of urgency in my voice, of rising hysteria. I couldn't imagine her writing a letter, or posting it, or doing any of the things that mortals habitually did. It was as if no common nature united us, or ever had. "I hope you're right in your estimation of yourself," she said.
"I don't believe in anything, Mother," I said. "You told Armand long ago that you believe you'll find answers in the great jungles and forests, that the stars will finally reveal a vast truth. But I don't believe in anything. And that makes me stronger than you think."
"Then why am I so afraid for you?" she asked.
Her voice was little more than a gasp. I think I had to see her lips move in order to hear her. "You sense my loneliness," I answered. "My bitterness at being shut out of life. My bitterness that I'm evil, that I don't deserve to be loved, and yet I need love hungrily. My horror that I can never reveal myself to mortals. But these things don't stop me, Mother. I'm too strong for them to stop me. As you said yourself once, I am very good at being what I am. These things merely now and then make me suffer, that's all."
"I love you, my son," she said.
I wanted to say something about her promising, about the agents in Rome, that she would write. I wanted to say,
"Keep your promise," she said.
And quite suddenly I knew this was our last moment. I knew it, and I could do nothing to change it.
"Gabriel," I whispered.
But she was already gone. The room, the garden outside, the night itself were silent and still. Some time before dawn, I opened my eyes. I was lying on the floor of the house, and I had been weeping, and then I had slept. I knew I should start for Alexandria, but I should go as far as I could and then down into the sand when the sun rose. It would feel so good to sleep in the sandy earth. I also knew that the garden gate stood open, that all the doors were unlocked. But I couldn't move. In a cold, silent way, I imagined myself looking throughout Cairo for her, calling her, telling her to come back. It almost seemed for a moment that I had done it, that, thoroughly humiliated, I had run after her, and I had tried to tell her again about destiny, that I had been meant to lose her just as Nicky had been meant to lose his hands. Somehow we had to subvert the destiny. We had to triumph after all. Senseless, that. And I hadn't run after her. I'd hunted, and I had come back. She was miles from Cairo by now, and she was as lost from me as a tiny grain of sand in the air. Finally, after a long time, I turned my head. Crimson sky over the garden. Crimson light sliding down the far roof. The sun coming, and the warmth coming, and the awakening of a thousand tiny voices all through the tangled alleyways of Cairo, and a sound that seemed to come out of the sand and the trees and the patch of grass themselves. And very slowly, as I heard these things, as I saw the dazzle of the light moving on the roof, I realized that a mortal was near. He was standing in the open gate of the garden, peering at my still form within the empty house. A young, fair-haired European in Arab robes he was, rather handsome, and by the early light he saw me, his fellow European, lying on the tile floor in the abandoned house. I lay staring at him as he came into the deserted garden, the illumination of the sky heating my eyes, the tender skin around them starting to burn, like a ghost in a white sheet he was in his clean headdress and robe. I knew that I had to run. I had to get far away immediately and hide myself from the coming sun. No chance now to go into the crypt beneath the floor. This mortal was in my lair. There was not time enough even to kill him and get rid of him, poor, unlucky mortal. Yet I didn't move. And he came nearer, the whole sky flickering behind him, so that his figure narrowed and became dark.
"Monsieur,"
the solicitous whisper, like the woman years and years ago in Notre Dame who tried to help me before I made a victim of her and her innocent child.
"Monsieur, what is it? May I be of help?"
Sunburnt face beneath the folds of the white headdress, golden eyebrows glinting, eyes grey, like my own.
I knew I was climbing to my feet, but I didn't will myself to do it. I knew my lips were curling back from my teeth, and then I heard a snarl rise out of me and saw the shock on his face.
"Look," I hissed, the fangs coming down over my lower lip. "Do you see?"
And rushing towards him, I grabbed his wrist and forced his open hand flat against my face.
"Did you think I was human?" I cried.
And then I picked him up, holding him off his feet before me as he kicked and struggled uselessly.
"Did you think I was your brother?" I shouted.
And his mouth opened with a dry, rasping noise, and then he screamed. I hurled him up into the air and out over the garden, his body spinning round with arms and legs out before it vanished over the shimmering roof. The sky was blinding fire. I ran out of the garden gate and into the alleyway. I ran under tiny archways and through strange streets. I battered down gates and doorways and hurled mortals out of my path. I bore through the very walls in front of me, the dust of the plaster rising to choke me, and shot out again into the packed mud alley in the stinking air, and the light came after me like something chasing me on foot. And when I found a burnt-out house with its lattices in ruins, I broke into it and went down into the garden soil, digging deeper and deeper and deeper until I could not move my arms or my hands any longer. I was hanging in coolness and in darkness. I was safe.
6. I was dying, or so I thought. I couldn't count how many nights had passed. I had to rise and go to Alexandria. I had to get across the sea. But this meant moving, turning over in the earth, giving in to the thirst. I wouldn't give in. The thirst came. The thirst went. It was the rack and the fire, and my brain thirsted as my heart thirsted, and my heart grew bigger and bigger and louder, and still I wouldn't give in. Maybe mortals above could hear my heart. I saw them now and then, spurts of flame against the darkness, heard their voices, babble of foreign tongue, but more often I saw only the darkness, heard only the darkness. I was finally just the thirst lying in the earth, with red sleep and red dreams, and the slow knowledge that I was now too weak to push up through the soft, sandy clods, too weak conceivably to turn the wheel again. That's right. I couldn't rise if I wanted to. I couldn't move at all. I breathed. I went on. But not the way that mortals breathe. My heart sounded in my ears. Yet I didn't die. I just wasted. Like those tortured beings in the walls under Les Innocents. Deserted metaphors of the misery that is everywhere unseen, unrecorded, unacknowledged, unused. My hands were claws, and my flesh was shrunk to the bones, and my eyes bulged from the sockets. Interesting that we can go on like this forever, that even when we don't drink, don't surrender to the luscious and fatal pleasure, we go on. Interesting, that is, if each beat of the heart wasn't such agony. And if I could stop thinking. Nicolas de L'Enfant is gone. My brothers are gone. Pale taste of wine, sound of applause. But don't you think it's good what we do when we are there, that we make people happy? Good? What are you talking about, good? That it's good, that it does some good, that there is good in it. Dear God, even if there is no meaning in this world, surely there can still be goodness. It's good to eat, to drink, to laugh, to be together. Laughter. That insane music. That din, that dissonance, that never-ending shrill articulation of the meaninglessness. Am I awake? Am I asleep? I am sure of one thing, I am a monster. And because I lie in torment in the earth, certain human beings move on through the narrow pass of life unmolested. Gabriel may be in the jungles of Africa now. Sometime or other mortals came into the burnt-out house above, thieves hiding, too much babble of foreign tongue. But all I had to do was sink deeper inside myself, withdraw even from the cool sand around me not to hear them.
Am I really trapped? Stink of blood above. Maybe they are the last hope, these two camping in the neglected garden, that the blood will draw me upwards, that it will make me turn over and stretch out these hideous, they must be, claws. I will frighten them to death before I even drink. Shameful. I was always such a beautiful little devil, as the expression goes. Not now. Now and then, it seems, Nicky and I are engaged in our best conversations. "I am beyond all pain and sin," he says to me. "But do you feel anything?" I ask. "Is that what it means to be free of this, that you no longer feel? Not misery, not thirst, not ecstasy?" It is interesting to me in these moments that our concept of heaven is one of ecstasy, the joys of heaven, that our concept of hell is pain, the fires of hell. So we don't think it very good not to feel anything, do we? "Can you give it up, Lestat? Or isn't it true that you'd rather fight the thirst with this hellish torment than die and feel nothing? At least you have the desire for blood, hot and delicious and filling every particle of you. Blood. How long are these mortals going to be here, above in my ruined garden? One night? Two nights? I left the violin in the house where I lived. I have to get it. Give it to some young mortal musicians, someone who will..." Blessed silence, except for the playing of the violin, and Nicky's white fingers stabbing at the strings, and the bow streaking in the light, and the faces of the immortal marionettes, half entranced, half amused. 100 years ago, the people of Paris would have got him. He wouldn't have had to burn himself. Got me too, maybe, but I doubt it. No, there never would have been any witch's place for me. He lives on in my mind now, pious mortal phrase. And what kind of life is that? I don't like living here myself. What does it mean to live on in the mind of another? Nothing, I think. You aren't really there, are you? Cats in the garden. Stink of cat blood. Thank you, but I would rather suffer, rather dry up like a husk with teeth. 7. There was a sound in the night. What was it like? The giant bass drum, beaten slowly in the street of my childhood village as the Italian players announced the little drama to be performed from the back of their painted wagon. The great bass drum that I myself had pounded through the street of the town during those precious days when I, the runaway boy, had been one of them. But it was stronger than that. The booming of a cannon echoing through valleys and mountain passes. I felt it in my bones. I opened my eyes in the dark, and I knew it was drawing nearer. The rhythm of steps it had, or was it the rhythm of a heart beating? The world was filled with the sound. It was a great, ominous din that drew closer and closer, and yet some part of me knew there was no real sound, nothing a mortal ear could hear. Nothing that rattled the china on its shelf or the glass windows, or made the cats streak to the top of the wall. Egypt lies in silence. Silence covers the desert on both sides of the mighty river. There is not even the bleat of sheep, or the lowing of cattle, or a woman crying somewhere. Yet it was deafening, this sound. For 1 second I was afraid. I stretched in the earth. I forced my fingers up towards the surface. Sightless, weightless, I was floating in the soil, and I couldn't breathe suddenly. I couldn't scream, and it seemed that if I could have screamed, I would have cried out so loud all the glass for miles about me would have been shattered. Crystal goblets would have been blown to bits, windows exploded. The sound was louder, nearer. I tried to roll over and to gain the air, but I couldn't. And it seemed then I saw the thing, the figure approaching, a glimmer of red in the dark. It was someone coming, this sound. Some creature so powerful that even in the silence the trees and the flowers and the air itself did feel it. The dumb creatures of the earth did know. The vermin ran from it, the felines darting out of its path. Maybe this is death, I thought. Maybe by some sublime miracle it is alive, death, and it takes us into its arms,